From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Lorna Luft talks about her mother, Judy Garland. Sunday's made-for-TV movie, Me and My Shadows, is based on Luft's memoir about life with her mother. Also, Mississippi-born singer and musician Olu Dara. His last album met with critical and popular acclaim and featured him singing for the first time. Now he's at it again with his new CD, Neighborhoods. Also, film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Monkey Bone, the new animated live-action film starring Brendan Fraser. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross.
I can't give you anything but love, baby. That's the only thing I've plenty of, baby. Dream a while, scheme a while, you're sure to find happiness, and I guess all those things you've always pined for, gee, I'd like to see you looking swell, baby.
Judy Garland, recorded 40 years ago at Carnegie Hall. A new made-for-TV movie, Life with Judy Garland, Me and My Shadows, tells the story of the volatile star's life from the point of view of her daughter, Lorna Luft. It's based on Luft's 1998 memoir about coming of age in the shadow of her mother and her half-sister, Liza Minnelli. Luft has starred on Broadway in Promises, Promises, and in national tours of Grease, They're Playing Our Song, and Guys and Dolls. She's sung at the Rainbow Room, the Hollywood Bowl, and the White House. Life with Judy Garland, Me and My Shadows, starring Judy Davis, airs this Sunday night on ABC. Terry spoke with Lorna Luft in 1998 about her mother's film and music career. She told Terry that when Judy Garland was signed to MGM as a teenager, the studio executives thought she needed a makeover.
Well, you see, in those days, they had sort of a mold of what, quote, movie stars were supposed to look like. So they analyzed you. Actually, in the movie of A Star is Born, there's a wonderful scene where she goes into the makeup room, and basically they are doing the exact same thing that they honestly did to her when she was 14, and they analyzed her nose was turned up and her teeth were a little this and what, and they analyzed her whole face, which I guess is all right for film, but it also is very hard as a child to hear that, and it's a bit degrading the way that, you know, they treated these people like they didn't take their feelings into account. But you also have to understand, people don't realize today how big MGM was. And I think the statistics will floor people that MGM did 2,500 makeups an hour. Their phone bill was the same as New York City. They were a factory and they were a city unto themselves. So they didn't really have a great deal of time to think about people's feelings, their, you know, what they were doing to them. These people were products to them.
Well, specifically, you say that the studio experts found your mother too short, too chubby, with a round spine and no neck, bad bite, nose turned up too much. Mm-hmm. Her eyes were the only thing that got a good review. What were the correctives that MGM found for your mother, Judy Garland?
Well, they would put little discs sometimes in her nose to make her nose not turn up. They did make special caps for her teeth so that they wouldn't... you know, she had a bit of an overbite. They dyed her hair different colors. When she started to develop into being a young woman, they, of course, bound her chest. They didn't want that. They did that throughout the whole Wizard of Oz. So they basically put out this product that they thought would, you know, they thought would sell to the movie-buying audience.
Roger Edens helped your mother get her first big break, which was singing You Made Me Love You to Clark Gable at a studio birthday party. How did he arrange that, and what role did he play in having her sing that song with a special lyric?
Well, he wrote Dear Mr. Gable, and he thought it would be a very, very nice gift to Mr. Gable. And he came up with the idea of having Mama sing the song. And, of course, he ran it by Mr. Mayer, and everyone thought it was a wonderful idea. And, of course, when it happened and when Mama sang the song, Mr. Gable apparently was just so touched and so, you know, he felt so wonderful about what had happened and that somebody had taken the time and all of it. He was truly grateful to Roger, and he thought it was really wonderful. And when they saw the reaction, of course, of everyone around, Mr. Mayer got this great idea to send them both out on tour together. And so they sent them out on a 2-week tour together. And poor Mama had to keep singing this song over and over and over again. And Clark had to sit there and pretend like he was hearing it for the first time. And she once told me that finally, after about, I don't know, the 30th time, he said, if you sing that song again, I'm going to strangle you. Was a bit tiring after a while.
Nevertheless, let's hear a recording of it that your mother made of Dear Mr. Gable.
Dear Mr. Gable, I am writing this to you, and I hope that you will read it so you'll know. My heart beats like a hammer, and I stutter and I stammer every time I see you at the picture show. I guess I'm just another fan of yours, and I thought I'd write and tell you so. You made me love you. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. You made me love you, and all the time you knew it. I guess you always knew it.
That's Judy Garland, and my guest is her daughter, Lorna Luft, who's written a new family memoir called Me and My Shadows. How old were you the first time you saw The Wizard of Oz, and what impression did it make on you?
I was about... four. Actually, I was a little bit older. Maybe I was about five. And we were in our house in Holmby Hills. My brother Joe was about two. And the movie was on television, and our nanny at the time thought it would be just wonderful to make the impression on us that that was our mother. And she kept telling us that that was our mother. Now, my mom was in New York at the time, and when she realized that, of course, the movie was going to be on television, she called the house to hear two children just hysterical, crying. And she said, what's happened? What's the matter? And we said, the monkeys took you to New York, and we were sobbing, and because it's a frightening movie for little kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, to be told that's your mother, well, it just scared the hell out of us.
You say that the year your mother made The Wizard of Oz, when she was 16, was also the year that she first took Benzedrine, which she was prescribed by people at the studio. What was she prescribed it for?
Weight loss. You see, in those days, this was sort of a little white pill that was sort of a little miracle drug. They knew that it cut your appetite. It knew it gave you a little bit of energy. And to a lot of people, it was harmless. And a lot of people were taking it. A lot of people were taking it. The writers were taking it. Truck drivers were taking it. Doctors were prescribing it because they didn't see any harm in it. And this is a very well-known sort of documented fact that the studios started to give certain people this little pill, not knowing what they were doing, not knowing that what the outcome would be in later life. Was it careless? Yes. Was it meant to be destructive? I don't think so. I honestly believe they did not want to hurt these people because they wanted to make money from them.
Sure, where's the percentage in making it so that they can't function because they're addicted to drugs? So she was also prescribed sleeping pills.
Well, yeah, when she couldn't go to sleep at night. Then, of course, you know, she was prescribed sleeping pills. Again, harmless, won't hurt you. Again, very, very wrong. But, of course, they didn't have the knowledge, they didn't have the education that, of course, that we know about today. They thought they were doing something that was all right to do.
So you think your mother was basically getting addicted to pills when she was a teenager, when she was in her mid-teens?
Sure.
Yeah. You say she had her first, you know, quote, nervous collapse on the publicity tour for The Wizard of Oz.
Well, look at the movie. They worked these people so hard. They didn't really, I mean, they did have child labor laws, but they weren't quite enforced. So, I mean, they worked these people so desperately hard. Because you've got to remember something. MGM was putting out a movie a week into the theaters that they owned. So, I mean, it was extraordinary the hours that people were kept at the studio and how they were, you know, how long they had to work. So that was their main concern. Their main concern was making money.
And your mother was already a teenager when she was doing publicity for The Wizard of Oz, but she was playing much younger in the movie than she really was. Mm-hmm. You say she really hated having to have that more girlish image. And, I'm wondering what effect you think that had on her, playing younger in the movies than she really was.
Well, you know, she was 16. And when you're 16, that's also a very, you know, in-between age. In fact, she sang a wonderful song called I'm Just an In-Between. And you're not an adult, yet you're not a child, but you don't quite know what you are at the age of 16, but to be told that you are not 16 or not to look 16 or not to look any older, you know, you want, for some reason, I know all of us want to grow up. All of us want to be older when we're that age. We want to be a little more sophisticated, and we want to, I guess, do the things that what grown-ups do. And to be constantly, you know, told you can't do this, you have to look like this, and you have to do, it's hard. And again, it takes a toll on your self-esteem.
Your mother's first two husbands were much older than she was, David Rose and Vincent Minnelli. You saw that as some kind of, in retrospect, you see that as almost like an act of rebellion against the youthful image she was forced into having.
Well, I think so. She had a wonderful, I shouldn't say wonderful, she had a famous sort of love affair with the brilliant screenwriter Joe Mankiewicz, and the studio just completely went cuckoo about that because he was a lot older and basically said, if this doesn't stop, we'll fire him, and, you know, it was quite awful. So they, you know, they broke that up. So, of course, that leads to rebellion. So she said, fine, if you're going to do that, I'll do this. And this was a rebellion of a person who had started to become the number one box office attraction at MGM. And she had made all these movies with Mickey Rooney. And of course, she was always the girl next door, and she, you know, he was always in love with a prettier girl, and then of course he would fall in love with her, and she was sort of always, you know, his best friend and all of that. So again, she was never looked at as, quote, you know, one of the great beauties of MGM. Certainly, you know, there was Hedy Lamarr and Lana Turner and all of these, you know, the great beauties of Metro. And there was Mama, and she was always feeling insecure about, you know, the roles that they would put her into and why they wouldn't let her grow up and all of that. And so I think that's, it's a pretty normal thing to rebel against all of that.
Lorna Luft, a new made-for-TV movie, Me and My Shadows, about Luft's mother, Judy Garland, airs this Sunday on ABC. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Terry Gross's 1998 interview with Lorna Luft.
So did your mother sing around the house when you were growing up?
Yeah, she would. I mean, she wouldn't, you know, everybody would, you know, she didn't constantly wake up and burst into song or open the refrigerator door and the light would go on and she would sing. She used to sing in the car when we would have the radio on, or she would teach us songs, but she didn't constantly, you know, that was her work. And she loved to sing, and she loved, you know, putting on records that she had just recorded and all of that. But she didn't just constantly, you know, sing around the house.
What advice did your mother give you about singing when you were young?
What she gave me about singing was basically, I mean, when she would hear me sing, she basically would never, she would never criticize me, but she would say things just very, very tenderly. Try to make this sound, try to, she would encourage me. She would never, ever put me down or say, you know, that's not right or whatever. I didn't realize, as I've said before, that Judy Garland was giving me singing lessons. It was my mother.
Right. On one of her TV shows, she sang a song called Lorna with a lyric, I think, written by Johnny Mercer for you. How did the lyric go?
The lyric was, It's a wonderful, first the melody was written by Mort Lindsey, and it was the melody to her television show. It was the theme song to her television show. And of course, there's never been a song called Lorna. And she was doing a segment on the show dedicated to the three of us. And of course, you know, Liza was written by the Gershwins. And then Happiness Is Just a Thing Called Joe is a wonderful song. And then it came to my song, and there wasn't one. So she had this song especially written for me. And she never told me about it until the night of the show, and it was at the taping, and we were sitting there, and all of a sudden she asked me if I would stand up in the audience, and she came right down to the footlights and she sang this song to me, and I was so touched. And it was just, what was really wonderful was it, I didn't realize where I was. It was just Mama and myself, and I was so enraptured, and I was so proud of this moment. I can't remember the audience. I don't remember cameras. I don't remember anything. I just remember that it was her and I.
I think it was about a year before your mother died, you moved out of the house and moved in with your father. Your parents had already separated by then. What made you decide to move out? What was like the turning point for you?
There was just my mother's life started to just spin out of control. The addiction was just devastating. The bad choices with managers, agents, career, and just being ill with this problem had just spun so out of control. And I was 15 years old, and I didn't see, I couldn't do it. I couldn't take care of her anymore. I knew that for my own sanity and survival, I had to walk away.
You're pretty convinced that your mother died of an accidental overdose, not
absolutely
a suicide.
No.
What makes you certain of that?
Because my mother's ego would never let her do that to herself. She liked herself. She, you know, she would never, ever do that on purpose. It was,
But she had made several suicide attempts.
Whenever my mother made a suicide attempt, it was always right after she called someone and said she was going to do that. All right? It was an attention getter. All right? Which is also the behavior of someone who has a lot of problems. But, you know, I'm a firm believer, if someone says they're going to kill themselves, they don't tell anybody. They just do it. The person who says, I'm going to kill myself, is not really going to kill themselves. They want to be stopped. They want to be helped. They're crying out for help. That's what she would do. And plus the fact when it would happen, she was over-medicated. She had over-medicated herself, and she didn't know what she was doing.
You know, you say in your book that it was really irritating for a while that you would be billed either as Judy Garland's daughter or Liza Minnelli's sister. Has it been hard for you to establish yourself as yourself on your own terms?
Oh, I think it has. I think that it has. It's become, it was hard at the very, very beginning. But I knew that, all right? The only thing that ever really, really bothered me at the beginning of my career was when they would compare me and not give me a critique on my own merit. You know, people, I'm desperately proud of my heritage, and I'm desperately proud of the family that I was born into. But, you know, people are very funny. People come up to me sometimes and they say, oh, we like you so better than, you know, so-and-so. And that to me, I know they think they're giving me a compliment, but in a way, I'd rather them just say, gee, we liked you.
Lorna Luft, speaking with Terry Gross. Life with Judy Garland, Me and My Shadows, airs this Sunday night on ABC. Let's listen to Lorna Luft singing I Got Rhythm from the 1990 cast recording of Girl Crazy. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Days can be sunny with never a sigh. Don't need what money can buy. Birds in the tree sing their day full of song. Why shouldn't we sing along? Get that way, look at what I've got. I got rhythm, I got music, I got my man who'd ask for anything more. I got daisies in green pastures, I got my man who could ask for anything more. Old man Trouble, I don't mind him, you won't find him round my door. I got starlight, I got sweet dreams, I got my man. Who could ask for anything more? Who could ask for anything more?
Coming up, Olu Dara, the musician and singer, has a new CD following his highly acclaimed solo album 3 years ago. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Monkey Bone, the new animated live-action film starring Brendan Fraser. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross.
Strange things happen every day. Strange things happen every day. Rolling down on a horse named Jimmy. Took a bath in a tub full of rimming. Had my companions with me, y'all. I'm a slow-running tiger,
yeah.
Fast-walking snail.
Yeah.
I'm a skinny bee locked in a jibber jail. Skinny bee locked in a jibber jail. D-train laughing at the gasoline train. Three girls begging for a date with Iron Mike. Iron Mike, yeah. Three girls begging for a date with Iron Mike. Lord. Alabama cornbread dipped in Georgia buttermilk.
Music from Oladara's new CD, Neighborhoods. Oludara started his career in the 70s and 80s when he was part of the avant-garde loft scene and worked as a sideman with such adventurous jazz composers as David Murray and Henry Threadgill. In 1998, he released his first CD, a recording that bridged the music of Mississippi, where he grew up, with the sounds of New York, where he's lived since the 60s. Jazz critic Bob Blumenthal wrote in a review, Oludara creates a folk, blues, Afrobeat CD stew where his singing and guitar playing are as prominent as his horn. In his new CD, Neighborhoods, Oludara adds a good bit of funk to the mix. Terry Gross spoke with Oludara in 1998.
How did you learn to play trumpet? And, you know, just like the cliche of Mississippi is almost that when you're born, they issue you a guitar so you can sing the blues. How did you end up with the trumpet?
Well, the trumpet, I guess we came from another side of town, I guess, and I met a man who just found his way into Natchez, and he was looking for a place to stay, something to do, and he turned out to be a very brilliant man, and I would help him. I helped him unpack his goods. His name was Lavanda Kynes, and he was a very young man. I thought he was older because he was mixed gray. But he asked me, what did I want to do? I asked him, what could he teach me? He said, anything. I remember that today. He said, anything. So, and he did teach me anything I wanted to learn. I started with clarinet first, piano, and the cornet. And I learned typing in there with him, how to set a typeset for newspaper, you know, photography, filmmaking. This was in the 40s. Tap dancing, metaphysical talk, you know, art, everything. He was that kind of a guy. So I stayed around him at all times, and I started playing cornet with him at the age of 7. And at the age of 9 or 10, I was traveling with him throughout Louisiana and Mississippi.
Playing?
Playing, yeah, playing cornet.
Huh. Was it unusual for him to be traveling with somebody that young?
No, it wasn't unusual for young kids in Mississippi to travel. Young, I mean, during that time, kids could, I was driving a car at 11.
Wow.
You know, and, we were drinking at 12 in public. That was in the 40s and early 50s, you know. So I thought the whole world lived like that, you know. But Mississippi evidently is different.
Now, you left Natchez in 1958 to go to Tennessee State. In Nashville to study music, yes? To study music there?
No, I went to study medicine.
Medicine?
Medicine, yes. I was going to go from there to Meharry University, which was right there, medical school, which is in the same city. That was our plan. I say our plan because, you know, my mother was involved in that plan also. But I decided that Nashville was so rich with music and the campus where I went to school, Tennessee State, was so rich with wonderful musicians, I decided to join the band and still studying medicine, pre-med, taking pre-med courses, but I just got the music bug. So what I did was I decided to go to the Navy School of Music. I joined the Navy and went to the Navy School of Music in Washington, D.C., only because I heard that John Coltrane and Cannonball Adderley and Clark Terry had gone to that school. So I decided to go to the Navy, and that's what happened. I did a year in school there, and then I played for another 3 years on ship.
So you went through the Navy in the Naval Band?
Yes.
So what kind of material would you have to play on ship?
Anything from Nearer My God to D, to marches, to dance music. I mean, we would be at the sea sometimes a long time, and we play dance music, you know? We play dance music, we would play anything. Anything they wanted you to play, you had to play. And then back on shore, you play nightclubs, officers' clubs, play jazz clubs, you know, officers' clubs who like jazz and play for dances. You have to play everything, play big bands also.
Now, how did you end up staying in New York after your years in the Navy?
I spent my last year in the military in New York. I was discharged in New York. I stayed around, and I ran out of money in New York. I was planning on going back to East Africa or Spain somewhere to live. I was only 24 years old, so I had nothing but freedom, nothing but time. And I ran out of money in New York, so I wound up in New York City.
I understand after you ended up in New York and decided to live there, you went for 8 years without performing.
Yes, I think it's around at 64, 70, yeah, maybe 8 years or whatever.
Why?
Well, I was kind of intimidated with the big New York scene. You know, I was still a small town person, uh-huh. And I was living in a neighborhood with all these great artists I had heard about. I'd seen them in person. I've seen their records. Heard their records or whatever, and I didn't think I was capable of playing on their level. And I hadn't tried, so, you know, I just thought that I was not good enough to play with them. And until I was basically forced into playing with them in a way they would, I would run into musicians who knew me in school, high school or college or the military, and they remember my talent better than I did. So eventually I got pushed back into the music world. So it just happened naturally, I believe.
Oludara, speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. His new CD is Neighborhoods. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're featuring an interview with jazz musician Oludara. His new CD is Neighborhoods.
He ended up playing in Art Blakey's band for a while, the Jazz Messengers. And,
yes,
and Blakey's
I did.
Band was always considered just like a training ground for, mm-hmm. for great musicians. I'm wondering what it was like for you.
Yeah, it's a good training ground for jazz musicians especially. But I felt that I had had enough of that. I thought I needed that. I thought that's what I really wanted. But you have to go somewhere to find out what you don't need, you know? And I found Blakey was very very nice. He's a very sweet man. He saw that I had another vision. So he let me explore my vision within his group. Most musicians would not allow you to do that. He allowed me to sing, which I wasn't a singer, or to tell jokes, or to play different trumpet styles that I didn't get a chance to play with other bands. And when I left this band, I had another vision. I knew exactly what I wanted to do.
What?
And I wanted to explore music that I really enjoyed. I guess you call it world music now, but at the time, in the early 70s, my thinking was that I wanted to play everything that I could play that was enjoyable to me, and I knew it would be enjoyable to my listeners, and I didn't want to bore myself or my listeners with the same sound.
A lot of jazz listeners were introduced to your work in the mid-70s through the 80s when you were playing early on in that period in what was known as the loft jazz scene. And then you were a really important sideman in bands led by the emerging composers of the period, composers who had a foot in the avant-garde, thinking of people like Henny Threadgill and David Murray, Julius Hempel. And I'm wondering how you fell in with that group of people, those emerging composers of the time, who were very adventurous in their compositions and drawing on basically all of jazz history.
Well, it was a... I don't know how it happened either, but I do remember being here before they were here, and they were you could say, immigrating from cities. Chicago, the St. Louis musicians, the California musicians, and I was already here, and they found it very difficult to find good trumpet players who could interpret their music since it was new to this area. And I was also looking for something else to do, because I had just left Art Blakey's group and there was nothing else happening here. And so when they came here, it was a perfect opportunity for me to do something and to be able to help them expand the sounds they wanted to get out here. And I found it very easy for me to fit in with their groups, and I found that I was some use to their bands. And it really helped me, and I think I really helped them.
I want to play something from a 1980 album that you were on. This is the David Murray Octet. The album is called Ming, and I'll play a David Murray composition called Dewey Circle. And you're featured on cornet or trumpet on this? I'm trying to remember.
Oh, it must be trumpet.
And you're very prominently featured on this, and you take the first solo. So let's hear Dewey Circle, recorded in 1980. My guest, Olu Dara, on trumpet. It was Dewey Circle from the 1980 David Murray album, Ming, and we heard David Murray on tenor, Henry Threadgill on alto saxophone, my guest Olu Dara on trumpet. The energy on that recording is so great and really typical of some of the best kind of playing of that period, combining like the energy of the avant-garde with the energy of, say, New Orleans music of the 20s and 30s and the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Did you like that kind of energy, that combination of contemporary adventurousness with the early spirit of jazz?
It was a very difficult period for me. Let's be truthful about this.
Okay.
I was like a fish out of water because I didn't come up playing that type of music, nor was I playing it ever up until that time. And I was just listening to that recording and knowing what I was feeling then when I was playing it, you know? It's hard to explain in words. But I like to use the word interesting because.
Oh yes, I know.
You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
Yeah, I was trying to find my way within the on the sharp edges of that music, because that music was atonal in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I came up in a tonal world. You know, so it was geometrical. If you can understand what I mean by that, you know, trying to fit sometimes like trying to fit a triangle into a square.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that it was scientific in that way. So I enjoyed the scientific aspect of the music. And I enjoyed being from another culture. It's like being from another culture, trying to play into another culture's thing. That's really all it's about. And you don't know what it is, but you try to figure out what you can do to help it. And that was my job. You know, to try to make it better than it was, or try to add an ingredient that they did not have.
So, you know, being from a small town, being from the South, being from a tonal world, did you sometimes feel like you were in another country when you were in New York playing?
Look, you just read my mind, because that's just the way I felt. I always felt that New York, the island of New York, is another country. You know, when you really look at it, you know. It's an international feeling, of course, but I could be anywhere, you know. I've been in other places, it feels, has the same feeling, out of this country.
You've said about your own music, I've been put here to relieve tension, which I thought was a very interesting thing to say. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I guess I've felt that all my life, because I always felt that people had little problems, you know. Even in the first grade, I felt that people were so uptight or not comfortable with themselves or their surroundings. And I always had a sense of humor, and I think I used my sense of humor to relax people, to relieve tension. I found that was my job in my community, in school, in my family, or whatever. Even now, today, I find people are very, I don't know what word to use, but not comfortable, you know. And being an artist and entertainer, I felt that my job was to relieve tension, because, you know, when I get up on stage, the light comes on, I look out in the audience first. And I'm comfortable, and they are not. And they paid to see me. And I just always wonder why. They should be really comfortable. I should be the nervous one, you know? But I found it's the other way around. People are just not very relaxed. I don't know what it has to do with the culture, or has to do with human nature or whatever. The human being is very tense. Very aggressive, and can be very scary. So I felt the way to help myself get through this maze of uptightness is to have a sense of humor and to be a stress reliever myself. You don't have to go to the pharmacy to get me. I'm right here in the flesh.
How did you get your name Oludara?
An African priest, a Yoruba priest, spoke to me one day. He said, you know, I was dealing with coconut shells, reading coconut shells the other night, and asked my God through the shells what your name was, you know, in another life. And the shells told me that your name was Oludara. And the name fit me so perfectly. This was in the 60s.
Is this when you were in the Navy?
Right after I got out of the Navy. Uh-huh. It means God is good. And I accepted that name. I called my father and told him that I had accepted another name that fit my personality.
What'd your father say? I think sometimes parents would be very offended by having, you know, the family name replaced.
Well, he just said, are you a communist? That's all he said. That's all he said, and I laughed, you know. You know, I think he thought it was a Russian name or something, you know.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Oludara, from a 1998 interview with Terry Gross. Here's some more music from his new CD, Neighborhoods.
I want to go to the movies, show me and my baby. Come on, let's go. Let's go. I buy the popcorn,
As soon as we hit the door, my two brothers Bell and Pons sitting in the front row. They bought the candy. We don't need nothing more. I love a movie show, I tell you, in black and white. I don't care what it is. I don't care how small the theater is. I don't care who's playing. I don't care how long they got popcorn and candy bars. Butterfly McQueen, she's gone with the wind. I love the film of Anthony Quinn. The Creature from the Black Lagoon, Red River, Color Purple. I love the movies. Clark Gable, all the women out there, the Barrymores and Sidney Poitier.
Coming up, a review of the new film Monkey Bone. This is Fresh Air. Monkey Bone is a new movie that combines live action with stop motion and computer animation. It's directed by Henry Selick, who made The Nightmare Before Christmas and James and the Giant Peach. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
In these days of South Park, an animated live action comedy about a cartoonist in explicit sexual competition with one of his own creations doesn't exactly come hurtling out of left field. But Henry Selick's Monkey Bone is unique. Partly that's thanks to its imaginative and ingenious mixture of pared-down cell animation, stop motion, and computer generation. Partly it's because its action unfolds in both the real world and the unconscious, perhaps even a Jungian universal unconscious. For all its adolescent jokes about erections and other comically irrepressible elements of desire, Monkey Bone is about the mysterious link between sex and death. Shorn of romance, sex, at least the male adolescent variety, is depicted as the ultimate psychic reflex, an instinctive craving that will cannibalize the rest of the self in order to get what it wants. Brendan Fraser stars as Stu Miley, your basic schlubby cartoonist, whose comic book hero, a lively monkey named Monkey Bone, is about to become the star of its own TV series. The first episode, which we see in its cell-style entirety, depicts the birth of Monkey Bone from the crotch of a junior high school kid having his first unexpected and alarming erection. This birth is embarrassing not just to the kid in the cartoon, but even to Stu, who's watching the film along with network executives, sponsors, his manager, and his longtime girlfriend Julie, played by a prettier-than-ever Bridget Fonda. Fraser, who does Cute But Shy the way Mount Etna does Lava, plays Stu as so bumbling and bashful that he stays aw-shucks simple even after he gets into an auto accident that leaves him in a coma. His self-effacing consciousness descends into a strange limbo called downtown, which is inhabited by all manners of creatures, including a newly personified Monkey Bone. Downtown is just the sort of off-the-wall experience you'd expect from Selick. Stu arrives by roller coaster. Strange stop-motion hybrids meet him on a ramshackle platform pitched precariously over an endless void. The town itself is based on the overworked theme of the Nightmare Carnival, but the inhabitants, who range from more stop-motion creatures to animatronic puppets and elaborately costumed and made-up actors, help make up for the overfamiliar housing stock. The grandest of them all is the local ruler, Hypnos, the Greek god of sleep. He has the head, shoulders, and arms of the actor Giancarlo Esposito, but but his tiny goat body and legs are, well, who knows what. Whatever they are deliciously nightmarish. Downtown is a way station. Its human guests are visited by death's messengers who hand them either a ticket out or a summons to Thanatopolis, the capital of death. With the encouragement of Monkey Bone and Hypnos, Stu sneaks into Thanatopolis to steal one of those exit tickets, only to become the victim of betrayal. Here's what happens when he returns to downtown, ticket in hand.
Monkey Bone! You can talk about this! Come on, wait! Back here! Wait! No, you don't understand! He's got my exit pass!
Oh, I'm so sorry, Stu. It's just all part of the deal. We've got big plans for that body of yours!
What? No, this can't be happening!
Hypnos and Monkey Bone have cut a deal to keep Stu stuck in downtown, where his troubled sleep will provide entertaining nightmares for the residents. Monkey Bone gets to inhabit Stu's body back on Earth and get a shot at having sex with Julie. The noisy clip is a fair indication of the movie's raucous tone, which can get a bit overwhelming. And its humor, though mostly provocative and satirical, sometimes is merely facetious, as when Whoopi Goldberg shows up to portray death. Still, the animation alone makes Monkey Bone worth a look. Selleck's decision to pitch a film at the young male audience, while still hewing to a theme of unusual seriousness, makes it remarkable.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave. We'll close today's program with music from guitarist John Faye, who died yesterday following open-heart surgery. He's best known for his solo guitar work that combines blues, folk, and experimental sounds. John Faye was 61.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Confessions of a Shopaholic, a novel by British author Sophie Kinsella. This is NPR, National Public Radio.